You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Robert Haas, who is an American poet. He has been named Poet Laureate recently. His books include Human Wishes, the most recent book of poetry, Praise, and Field Guide, for which he won the Yale Younger Poets Award. He's been translating the Nobel Prize-winning Czech poet Miloš and has an anthology of translations of haiku that comes from Echo Press, as well as an award-winning collection of essays called 20th Century Pleasures. In the summer of 1995, I met with our poet laureate, Robert Haas, at the Yellow Bay Writers' Conference. Haas was shy and modest when speaking about his own work, but animated on matters of modern literary theory, literacy, and the political responsibility of a laureate. What follows is a remarkable series of observations on contemporary letters taped in a dorm room in Missoula, Montana, at the Writers' Conference there. My guest is the American Poet Laureate, Robert Haas. I thought I'd begin by talking about 20th Century Pleasures and Praise as titles, because in a certain sense, the last thing that you expect to hear about the work of the 20th century is that it is a pleasure. Or at that time, about a book of poetry, that it would be called Praise. So I wanted to ask you about that impulse toward praise and pleasure.
Let's see, what do I have to say about that? A lot of people think 20th Century Pleasures is a terrible title for that book, and it was a sort of last-minute thought. Context, actually, I think, was from a sentence in the book in which I was talking about listening to the sound of your teeth being drilled. And I was thinking that that was a 20th century pleasure, or I gave it as an example of a 20th century pleasure. And so that it was sort of flippantly the title for the poem, for the book of essays. But I'm very interested in pleasure. It's certainly one of the true things about art, that one of its aims is pleasure. And it's true that 20th century pleasure seemed a kind of horrifying and ironic title in a certain way. So out of a sort of, is the key word here, out of a not very well thought out and random and somewhat ironic series of impulses, I chose that title. Praise, yes. I was aware in that case that, in many ways it's a terrible thing to praise existence. And so for that reason, the title appealed to me.
The new book, Human Wishes, seemed to fall into the same pattern, at least as a ghost in my mind when I got the book. Oh, I said, the vanity of human wishes, mm-hmm. and that this book would leave out the vanity or their hopelessness, but leave the wish itself.
That was the case. I didn't even think about the what used to be the famous 18th century poem by Samuel Johnson, The Vanity of Human Wishes. Someone had told me that Beckett had intended to call a volume of his collected works in French, call it in French, I forget what it would be, Human Wishes. And the phrase was in my mind. And it was only after the book was out that someone said, after it was a done deal that I was stuck with that title, that somebody said, The Vanity of Human Wishes. And then I liked that a lot, that it didn't pass judgment on this, fatal engine of our lives.
What is your response to the relationship of contemporary theory to modern poetry?
I guess the first thing I have to say, want to say about this is I have trouble with the idea of contemporary theory. It's like everyone uses it, and people in university say, theory, I'm studying theory. And it's a curious code because a lot of these people don't agree with each other. You know? I mean, how do I think, you think, saying, what do you think about contemporary theory is like saying, well, you know, what do you think about Greek philosophy, or what do you think about German philosophy? I mean, which one? Mm-hmm. What they all share, all the interesting ones share, is something that's interesting, useful, necessary, and worrisome, which is radical skepticism. You can kind of divide, I don't know, for people listening, I imagine this delicious audience of you out there who are not necessarily graduate students of literature. I don't know how much you know about this, but the university has been, in the humanities, been taken over almost entirely by a fascination with post-existentialist continental philosophy. And the main things in post-existential continental philosophy have been radical doubt about all the terms of existentialism, in which the I heroically defines itself against a given world in freedom moment by moment. The first thing they said, the structuralists, was, what freedom? We're not even free to make the sentences we make. We're not free in our choice of clothes. You don't see people going around in hose and doublets anymore. We're not free. It's not free. What the hell freedom are you talking about? And the second thing, the post-structuralist question was, who's the I who's supposed to be making these choices? Who is this person? The name on your driver's license? I is a problem, not an answer. This is a fiction that keeps us from our experience. And the third part of the question was, how do we know there's a world there at all? And the next step around 68, at the time of the Paris uprising, was to take all of these three radical skepticisms about the existence of a knowable world, about the existence of a knowable self, and about, I forget what I said the first one was, and about the notion of human freedom, and say, we have all of these things, and they're all illusions, and they're all constructed out of political ideology. Moreover, they're all constructed out of capitalist, bourgeois ideology, patriarchal, heterosexist, racist often, in order to construct a given reality that we find so that people can continue to go around washing their cars and making love and picking flowers and making money in this grotesquely unjust and cruel world. And the necessary thing to do to wake people up to all of this is to methodically deconstruct every one of their certainties about who they are, what the world is, and what possibility is. It's at its best, and then this was done playfully by nihilists in love with Nietzsche. It was done ferociously by Marxists. It was done ferociously by feminists. It's been done in a number of different spirits, by a number of different people, with different tones. Some of the tones I hate. Some of the tones I identify with powerfully. What's happened to it as, in order to do that, to reframe questions, you have to reframe language. And in the French version, there's an enormous amount of punning. All of that got immediately translated, and the word, I guess, is reified into gobbledygook jargon in the academy. So that it used to be that the people in the humanities were the one who could translate what everybody else says. Now, the only people in an academic occasion who can't be understood are the humanists, because they have this specialized language whose original purpose was to force people to question all the sort of terms of California individualism. You know, I'm going to find my true self. I'm blah, blah, blah. What true self? Come on, wake up. There's no true self. But it immediately became a jargon you use to get tenure. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think anybody used it that cynically, but you get into school, you see that's the way they're talking, you start using that language. If you want to write, be sexy at all, you never say I or person or human, you say subject. Because we could talk about why. You never say poem, book, story, you say text. These signal the intention to deconstruct. They're supposed to signal a kind of skeptic, and they stopped signaling. They've lost their original critical energy and have just become a bad academic vocabulary. So I think that the impulse behind, I think that, the, you know, the impulse to deconstruct was in Bebop. I think it was there. I think it was there in Creeley. I think it was there in Action Painting. There was a homegrown American deconstruction going on, in which I have to say the American intellectuals who do deconstruction have shown absolutely no interest, because they're in fact not interested, most of them, in work of art. They're interested in contesting theory with other theorists. So the impulse of deconstruction and of post-structuralism and all, and the poetics among the young, in, for example, the language poets in New York and California, comes out of it. Some of that work seems to me extraordinarily interesting. But I think the impulse that's in deconstruction never was not in contemporary poetry. Mm-hmm. Was there long before the academics got a hold of it. And I say that saying that there are academic writers who use it with great passion and skill and usefulness. But, you know, like anything, it's, you know, it wouldn't matter whether it was Jungian language or Freudian language or existential language. It gets flattened out when it becomes the given and fashionable technique. This doesn't exactly answer the question of what do I think about the influence of contemporary theory on, but one of the excitements of poetry, and it's often the excitement of difficult poetry, I think there's a huge interest now, you know. I mean, I think probably there's more poetry being written in this country and more of it read than ever in our history. It's a lot of lively work. The most difficult and demanding work that requires the most literary sophistication, I think, is the work that's being done in the spirit of deconstruction, or of, as people would now say, theory. So again, I don't think we can not ask these questions. Mm-hmm. There's no way we can not ask these. Whether we have to use this language and that tends to deaden so much of experience in order to ask them, I don't think one has to do that.
Well, it occurs to me that for better or worse, when these things came over, when one read Foucault's examination of Las Meninas, mm-hmm. one was reading a writer of considerable elan and style, mm-hmm. doing something extraordinary, mm-hmm. and looking carefully at a painting, mm-hmm. whose extraordinariness was also being respected. Mm-hmm. When one read Roland Barthes describing a phrase of Balzac in SZ, mm-hmm. that the snow was covering the trees, and he finds, in fact, in this story, that it's an image of warmth, mm-hmm. not cold, that the snow is blanketing these trees, and in fact, eventually, in the transvestite in the story, the blanketing will be the same. It's a kind of warmth, and mm-hmm. the clothing is like what the season has done for the transvestite, transformed him. When was reading the work of very accomplished and very sensitive responders to art and literature, mm-hmm. the grotesque or ugly thing to me has been that what has been jettisoned has been the sensitivity of response. What has been embraced has been the neologisms and the coined words, mm-hmm. that enabled the responses to be formularized. Mm-hmm. So the formulas have been embraced and extended, and methods that were generated to handle very particular objects mm-hmm. have been mass-produced to handle any object.
Mm-hmm.
And so what has gone in the process is the idea of style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think it's just a matter of style, because the other part with both, I mean, again, each of the four so-called great figures, or five or six, if you, that is, Barthes, Foucault, Lacan, Derrida, Irigaray, they're writers.
Mm-hmm.
They were exploring and trying to work this stuff out. And like all activity of exploration, it's exciting. I have mixed feelings about them. I think that Lacan is a quite perverse writer and a mystifier. And the more I read him, the more I dislike him. I think that Foucault is complicated because he's an increasingly exciting writer, but it's like reading through the history of his work is like watching someone. It's like watching the history of a Democrat turning into a dictator, like Mussolini or something like that. That Foucault began with this rage against power, and he's so fascinated with it at the end that you can't tell his contesting of it from it. So there's something unpleasant for me about this whole business of the working out of the master-slave relationship that gets mixed up with sadomasochistic sexuality, et cetera, in his work. Each of them is, you know, a is a writer who you want to read as a writer. Look at the history of the struggle. Look at, you know, this success, this failure, so on. And I think it's true that the people who took it over did not put themselves in the same relation either to the methods or the materials. They now say, it's formula. So that you wonder if they really think that the personal self, you know, is a prop to support capitalism. Why do they name their children, all of these assistant professors? Why, you know what I mean? There's just the point at which the distance between act. I mean, how does a postmodernist shop? You know, on what basis is choice made? And yet they seem to walk into stores like everybody else. So there's a certain point at which you get into the territory of Aristophanes, the clouds or something, where the gap between the philosophical position and the way humans behave is so great. And I think, by the way, it's going. I mean, the young, it's not lively enough for the young graduate students I see at Berkeley. You know, they're not that they're not interested in exactly these questions. You know, they got them from rock and roll before they even started studying literature. But
who wrote the Book of Love?
But it's going to change very fast because they're in full scale rebellion against this shit.
Well, the whole thing sort of reminds me of a somewhat eerie comment that Timothy Leary made after the whole drug thing, at least in terms of acid, mm-hmm. had died down. He said in a newspaper somewhere, well, acid was like rocket fuel, but most Americans are like lawnmowers. Mm-hmm. Why would you use rocket fuel in a lawnmower?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a feeling, too, mm-hmm. that most of this technology of deconstruction is like rocket fuel, but the people using it have the linguistic capabilities of lawnmowers. Mm-hmm. And so you see all of this extraordinary, you know, technology and fission, but it's as if the containers mm-hmm. are being annihilated by it, you know. They cannot hold the fuel. Anyway, but
it also reminds me of Freud's remark about Dostoevsky, who ended up, this, to use your word, luminous Christian visionary, but also a reactionary and an anti-Semite, he said, lesser minds have arrived at the same conclusions with far less effort. But, you know, I wanted to say for readers who are listeners, who are also readers who are listening to this conversation, to see what this skepticism about the surface of the text and the love we have of the way our personalities get organized by a sentence like Smiley looked out across gray London that puts us someplace for a while, or is to look at some of this work. And I can name a few books that they might want. For me, one of the most beautiful and interesting of them is a book by a woman from Berkeley named Lynn Higeni.
Oh, good.
Called My Life, which I think is maybe the best single work by a contemporary of mine to experiment with this breaking of surfaces. Another writer is Michael Palmer, who's maybe the book's Notes from Echo Lake, or Notes from Echo Lake would be a wonderful place to start. And one could name others, Susan Howe, Bob Perlman. There's a lot of boring work in this vein, because finally how much unconsecutive collage do you want to read? But there is some amazing and interesting, challenging, troubling, and beautiful work being done in this mode.
And finally, the opposite pole of the nihilist ravages of theory would seem to be an acceptance of the invitation to become the poet laureate of a nation like America. Do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, I suppose I do. I mean, what is my comment on that? I mean, a gesture toward this official stuff would be to say no, it's in some way the obvious gesture to say no. It was my first impulse, but I think that I'm not a Marxist. I'm a Simone Weilist. Weil said the only mistake Marx made was to think that the struggle ever stopped. I think that I was recently at a conference in which people were talking about literacy in America, the future. Our future as a people, who were founded partly on two ideas. One idea was that people had to get an education, and there had to be print, and it had to be cheaply available, because if most adults could read a book and master a complicated argument, you could have a democracy. And the second idea that came along later, the Matthew Arnold idea, was if this really terrific, great, soul-ennobling, troubling, disturbing works of art are not a property of a small aristocratic minority, but of everybody, we'll have a richer, livelier citizenship. The evidence is that the percentage of the population that could read, who did read serious books in the middle of the 19th century, is about 12 or 15%. The portion of the population that now reads is about 12 or 15%. Everybody has these fantasies that in some country or other, in Russia, why anybody would think in Russia they really love their poets, everybody loves poetry. In Chile, they really love their poems. They used to, in the 20s, people read a lot. There are all of these fantasy golden ages elsewhere in another time, and it's not true. It's just not true. It's never been much different. And that means if you in any way are committed to those ideals as fighting positions, then you have to fight for every additional reader, recognizing that the odds are against you, but you have to make that fight. In this state, where in California, where your program initiates, and where I live, school children are not being taught to read, and the governor keeps saying, money is not the problem. He's saying that at a moment when California went from spending more money per child than any other state in the union on literacy in the 1970s. Now in the 1990s, it's 48, somewhere between Mississippi and Alabama. There are more kids per classroom in California than in any other state in the union. You know, it's, and this has happened over 15 years, it's a disgrace. It's complete shame and disgrace, and it's because people want expendable income in their pockets, so they don't want their property taxes raised. So somebody has to say, if we're going to have readers, then you have to stop behaving in this cruel and selfish and self-indulgent way and get rid of people like Pete Wilson and insist on paying enough money to educate your children. You don't abandon them. We've done that. We've been degrading our schools. So anyway, I think that there are many reasons to have a pulpit in from which, for a year or two, to make an argument for what it means to be a citizen of a democracy, given the fact that it's a dubious matter to even say we have one. You know, you have to. What do you do if you don't? And it's what bothers me about the situation of academic deconstruction. You know, you can sit around in English departments and French departments forever deconstructing ideology, but then what do you do? Where do you go? I'm a child of this, of the New Left, of this earlier period of the 60s, and I believe in acting, trying to act in the world.
I've been speaking to Robert Haas, the author most recently of Human Wishes, published by Echo Press, translator of Milos. Most of the translations have come from Echo. Book of Haiku, a book of essays, 20th Century Pleasures, recently named as Poet Laureate of America. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
I'm here at the Yellow Bay Writers Conference. This show has been facilitated by Terry Conrad of KUFM in Missoula, Montana. You've been listening to Michael Silverblatt. Please join me again next week on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
And say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.